kingdom communications. Now, there's two aspects to the communications I'm going to talk about. One of them is out and one of them is up. This past week, we laid to rest our 41st President of the United States, George H.W. Bush, from lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda to services at the National Cathedral in Washington and St. Martin's Church in Houston. Much memorializing and eulogizing was done. He was remembered more fondly, if you have your cell phone, silence them. He was remembered more fondly than he was treated when president. Two things that stood out for me and were influential in preparing this sermon were the first thing, his 1,000 points of light campaign. The term was used by our 41st president in his speech accepting the presidential nomination at the 1988 Republican National Convention in New Orleans, written for Bush by Peggy Noonan and Craig Smith. The address likened America's clubs and volunteer organizations to a brilliant diversity spread like stars, like 1,000 points of light in a broad and peaceful sky. Bush reprised the phrase near the end of his speech, affirming that he would keep America moving forward, always forward, for a better America, for an endless, enduring dream and 1,000 points of light. An emphasis he made throughout his presidency is actually an indirect proclamation of his faith. He was ultimately speaking about communities and individuals in those communities with the essence of the gospel message and doing the work of the gospel. This is an excerpt from his speech. I have spoken of 1,000 points of light of all the community organizations that are spread like stars throughout the nation doing good. We work hand in hand, encouraging, sometimes leading, sometimes being led, rewarding. We will work on this in the White House and the cabinet agencies. I will go to the people and the programs that are the brighter points of light, and I will ask every member of the government to become involved. The old ideas are new again because they are not old. They are timeless. Duty, sacrifice, commitment, and a patriotism that finds its expression in taking part and pitching it. The very essence of this sounds like he's conveying a gospel message, a good news about the nation. You're keeping in mind the essence behind this message is 1,000 points of light can be viewed as the gospel itself. The other thing that was prominent during this week, his biggest regret. His greatest regret while he was president was that he was not more vocal about his faith when he was president. They call the presidency a bully pulpit. When the president speaks, people listen. He could have utilized that more. At least that's his regret. We learned from the exhaustive coverage of Bush's 41 passing that he was devout in faith, yet was not demonstrative in expressing his faith while in office. This didn't mean he was void of his faith, but merely looking back in hindsight, didn't communicate it in the manner he believed he should have done. Oh, I wish I could have said that. How many of us have had that experience? You're in a moment, then afterwards you're out of the moment. You say, well, why didn't I say that? Sometimes it's hard when you're in the moment. Which brings me to the point of my message, that of communications, more specifically kingdom communications. During the service in Washington, Jenna Bush Hager, 41's granddaughter, read portions of Revelation 21, communicating the destination where her grandfather would reside, a picture of the kingdom. She was communicating about the kingdom. This is something we are all supposed to do as representatives, talmidims, followers of the King, Yeshua. This is one means of communicating about the kingdom. Yet there is another means of communicating that is equally important, if not more so. It is a communication that keeps us connected to the kingdom. It is a communication that strengthens us for the kingdom in order that we may with confidence communicate about the kingdom. This means of communications is nothing more than prayer. Yeshua set a standard for this level of communications in order that you, that we would be effective. He first conveyed what not to do. Everybody turn to Matthew chapter 6. Keeping in mind, he's speaking that you will be effective. Verse 5. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who love to pray standing in the synagogues and on street corners so that people can see them. Yes, I tell you, they have their reward already. If you are praying and you are seeking it for reward, don't do what they're doing. But you, when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father in secret. Your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. What is this reward? Probably talk about it more. But if you look at it in any way, a reward in this manner is an answer to your prayer. A response. A dialogue, so to speak. He further conveys, don't do what the pagans do when they pray. Basically, the premise, if some is good, more must be better. Verse 7. And when you pray, don't babble on and on, like the pagans, who think God will hear them better if they talk a lot. What does Yeshua say? Let your prayers be yes, yes, and amen. It's not about the length. Although substance is important, it's about the quality. You don't need to beat around the bush with God when you're speaking to Him. Because we're going to see a few things as we read further. But what Yeshua is saying about prayer is something that was ultimately found in the culture of His time. Compare these excerpts from the Mishnah and the Gemara, the Talmud. And yes, there are good things that you can glean from the oral law. This is from Avot, which means fathers. Rabbi Shimon said, when you pray, do not make your prayer fixed, repetitive, mechanical, but appeal for mercy and supplication before the omnipresent, blessed be He. I love my mother-in-law. You know what's going to come after this, probably. When they have a devotional in the morning, then they pray. Doesn't matter what day you're there. If you're there often enough, you will know the prayer by heart yourself, because it's the same prayer every day. She reads. She doesn't read, but from memory, she lists everybody and prays for them. Yet it's the same prayer each time, unless something has changed. Every time I go up there, she says, I'm praying for your brother and for your father. I hear it every time. It's like, thank you. Needless to say, I didn't say, well, they really need it. And they do, but that's another story. Likewise, in the Gemara, it reads this. When you address the Holy One, blessed be He, let your words be few. Let your words be few. Sometimes we lead with an explanation of what we're going to pray for first. Moses' words to Adonai in Numbers 12, Lord, heal her. Speaking of Miriam. Keeping in mind it was for a time that she would have Zaharetz because of what transpired. But Moses' words were few. Another one. Remember, you are the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So when we look at verse 6 of Matthew 6, but you, when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father in secret. Your Father who sees what is done in secret. And this idea of that we will be rewarded, the first thing that comes to mind is a list to Santa. It is in essence a wish list of everything we want and desire. Yet it misses the mark. Our prayer should not be about substance in terms of what we're in need of. Because later on in Matthew chapter 6, Yeshua addresses this very issue. Yeshua conveys not to worry about the things you are in need of to live by. In verse 25, therefore I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Isn't life more than food and your body more than clothing? He says, don't worry. But he also cautions you and says, well, you walk in faith towards him. If there is a therefore, because keeping in mind, verse 25 started off, therefore. If there is a therefore, then there must be something before. This conclusion Yeshua draws in relation to our lives and the needs we have immediately comes after this verse, verse 24. No one can be a slave to two masters, for he will either hate the first and love the second, or scorn the second and be loyal to the first. You can't be a slave to both God and money. Listen closely. I am not saying don't ever pray for these things. In other words, communicating your burdens in prayer to our Father, but do not let them consume the majority of your prayers. Consider verse 8. Don't be like them because your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. He already knows. But there are times when prayer is not for Him, but it's reassurance for us. When if you look at it, in the entire context of Matthew 6, it is reiterated again in verse 32. For the pagans who set their hearts on all these things, your heavenly Father knows you need them all. Your Father knows even before you ask. Consider the parallel of Yeshua addressing the Pharisees about tithing. Now, how am I going to connect prayer and tithing? Watch. Woe to you hypocritical Torah teachers and Pharisees. You pay your tithes of mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the Torah, justice, mercy, trust. These are the things you should have attended to without neglecting the others. What is he talking about? A balance. you're neglecting one over the other. Don't neglect the weightier matters when you pray. Don't neglect your prayer for those who truly need their eyes opened. What you're going to see in a moment is what Yeshua is in essence conveying to us is something that's found throughout the culture, but is not what it has become today. Let me see if you get this. In first century Judaism, there were two main approaches to prayer. The public prayer of the temple and the synagogue and private prayer. Public prayer was formal. The style was highly elaborate and deferential, conducted in a series of benedictions in Hebrew. In contrast, private prayer was informal, direct, uttered in the vernacular and a way of praying that all could use. Call it the common man's method of praying. It did not require, as it were, any professional expertise or training. Rabbi Joseph Henneman suggests that Yeshua's teaching on prayer reflected this private tradition. Many scholars have noted parallels between the Lord's Prayer and the Kaddish, a hymn and praise of common synagogue prayer. Jewish scholar, again, Joseph Henneman, argues that Yeshua shows himself committed to the tradition of Jewish private prayer. As a Torah observant Jew, Yeshua faithfully attended temple and synagogue. He was not teaching against public prayer, but rather stressing the need for intimacy with God. Even in public prayer, there can be intimacy with God if there is faith-filled focus in the Holy One. Yet when we look further into these verses, this is not just a random collection of thoughts Yeshua has put together, but rather a guideline for establishing this intimate connection with Adonai, the Father. These verses include what is widely known as the Lord's Prayer. Since it was taught by Yeshua, that's how it's identified. All of its elements may be found in the Judaism of Yeshua's day. So in this sense, it is not original with him, but it is properly revered for its beauty and economy. Verse 9, Matthew chapter 6. You therefore pray like this, Our Father in heaven, may your name be kept holy. Avinu Shebashamayim opens many Hebrew prayers. Our Father in heaven. This isn't something that, let me just bring this out. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father and our King. Avinu Shebashamayim, our Father in heaven. Yeshua wasn't creating anything new, but was working within the framework of what was prevalent, what was prominent. And keeping in mind, may your name be kept holy. This next line brings about an understanding or a connection to the Kaddish, what we know as the mourner's prayer. Yit Gadol v'Yit Gadash, magnified and sanctified be His great name throughout the world, which He has created according to His will. And may He establish His kingdom in your lifetime. We say this in remembrance of others, but it's more not praying for them, but more consoling for us. Sometimes it might be discouraging, especially if we know that the person that has passed on is not a believer. does not believe in the kingdom or the king himself. So it could be a double-edged sword depending on who it is. Now the next part, verses 11 and 12. Even though this is viewed as a personal or private prayer, consider the focus. Give us the food we need today. Forgive us what we have done wrong, as we too have forgiven those who have wronged us. It may be personal in terms of not in a public setting, but it's community based. It's based on the greater of the community. What are we doing here? In a way, our personal prayer, we are interceding on behalf of others. Prepare my heart first before I pray for others. But our focus should be community-based, not I-based, not me-based. Yet when we look at a number of aspects within the body of Messiah, they tend to be I-centered and not community-based. You can stone me after the service if you didn't like what I just said. Give us, forgive us, lead us, is characteristically Jewish, focusing on the group rather than the isolated individual. You may be one, but you are more than one. Think of yourself like a chain. Think of yourself like a quilt of many panels knitted together. Whatever visual you look at, a chain is not made of one link but many's. A quilt is not made of one panel but many's. Many. The body of Messiah is not made of one individual but many. When we communicate, our communications, which is kingdom communications upwards, should be about the weightier matters. The community, the body of Messiah. Praying for the body and those in the body. Strengthening them. Praying that God strengthens them. Then praying for those outside the body, that God will open their eyes, that He will circumcise their hearts so that they can be part of the body on the inside, not looking out, not on the outside looking in. And then when we get to verse 13, and do not lead us into hard testing, but keep us safe from the evil one. For kingship, power, and glory are yours forever. The same dynamic in verse 13 as the previous verses. It's about us, not me. You are part of something that's bigger than you are. But it doesn't make you irrelevant to what you are part of. The evil one, the Greek, may be translated simply as evil, in the sense of bad things or the originator of bad things. The Talmud reports that whenever Rabbi Chayai ben Abba fell on his face in prayer, he used to say, "May the merciful one save us from the tempter." This isn't something new in the New Covenant, by the way. The adversary existed long before. For your kingship, your power, and your glory are yours forever. Keeping in mind, you have three dynamics here: kingship, power, and glory. Yet you have three things that are emphasized at the end of Matthew 28. The power, the Ruach HaKodesh, the authority, Yeshua, and the kingship, Adonai. All authority has been given to him. The glory is Adonai. So when we look at a passage such as Matthew 28, you pray in this manner in the name of the Father, Avinu, the Son, Yeshua, and the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh. You pray in the reality of God by the authority of Yeshua and within the power of the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. Then going back to verse 10, may your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We are part of the kingdom, but we are in essence praying on behalf of the kingdom, communicating to the kingdom on behalf of the kingdom. May your word go throughout the earth. May your will be done on earth. It's already being done where God resides. We do not need to pray for heaven. We need to pray for what goes on down here. So this is the aspect of communications to, not out. We're communicating to the kingdom. We're communicating to God. We are making it so that we become stronger. Your prayers should equip you. They should make you stronger as a believer. Yet before these verses, prior, Yeshua conveys another important element that further communicates about Adonai's kingdom dynamic. Everybody go back to Matthew chapter 6, starting in verse 1. Be careful not to parade your acts of tzedakah in front of people in order to be seen by them. If you do, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Tzedakah. What is tzedakah? Tzedakah, literally translated, means charity. But we can look at it as good deeds. We can look at it as you're giving something. So when you do tzedakah, don't announce it with trumpets to win people's praise, like the hypocrites in the synagogue and on the streets. Yet I tell you, they have their rewards already. But you, when you do tzedakah, don't even let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Then your tzedakah will be in secret, and your Father who sees what you do in secret will reward you. Some translations say they will reward you openly. Tzedakah, Hebrew for righteousness. But in the Jewish context, doing tzedakah means giving to charity or doing acts of mercy. This is reflected in the Greek text of Matthew 6. The Greek word used means righteousness in verse 1. But in verses 2 through 4, a different Greek word is used, which means kind deeds and charitable giving. In other words, the work of the kingdom. The will of Adonai being done on earth, our expression of being kingdom-minded, as is the prayer Yeshua instructs us to follow. I'm further reminded of another president, past president, with a message that is kingdom-minded as well. President Reagan conveyed this message on the shining city on a hill that was originally coined by John Winthrop, but was likely inspired by Matthew 5, 13, and 14. And I forgot that I had to do this. There we go. I want you to listen to these words. January 11, 1989.
And that's about all I have to say tonight, except for one thing. The past few days, when I've been at that window upstairs, I've thought a bit of the shining city upon a hill. The phrase comes from John Winthrop, who wrote it to describe the America he imagined. What he imagined was important because he was an early pilgrim, an early freedom man. He journeyed here on what today we call a little wooden boat. And like the other pilgrims, he was looking for a home that would be free. I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. And how stands the city on this winter night? More prosperous, more secure, and happier than it was 8 years ago. But more than that, after 200 years, two centuries, she still stands strong and true on the Granite Ridge, and her glow is held steady, no matter what storm. And she's still a beacon, still a magnet for all who must have freedom, for all the pilgrims from all the lost places who are hurtling through the darkness toward home. We've done our part, and as I walk off into the city streets, a final word to the men and women of the Reagan Revolution, the men and women across America who for 8 years did the work that brought America back. My friends, we did it. We weren't just marking time. We made a difference. We made the city stronger. We made the city freer. And we left it in good hands. All in all, not bad. Not bad at all. And so, goodbye. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
Matthew 5, 13 and 14. You are the salt for the land, but if salt becomes tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except being thrown out for people to trample on. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Interesting how the words of our 40th president conveys much of the dynamic of the kingdom. He was speaking of America, but very easily Yeshua could have used those words speaking of the kingdom. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Jewish believers are salt, a seasoning and a preservative for the land of Israel. That is for the Jewish people, and a light for the world, for the Gentiles, as taught in Isaiah 49:6. God established a covenant of salt, which is applied to King David and the descendants that is to the Messiah. The Jewish believers in the Messiah then are the righteous remnant of Romans 11, for whose sake God preserves Israel and the world. For more, preserves them for more. Sometimes Israel's messianic Jews feel that they are not part of the real Jewish community, being in the land. But the reason messianic Jews are here is to be the righteous remnant. President Reagan in his little speech, which was at the end, which was 2 minutes, the end of what he addressed. Strangely enough, he said, "I don't know if I communicated effectively enough," meaning over his 8 years. Yet President Reagan was known as the great communicator. We don't need an adjective for the one who is our communicator. He is the communicator, period. President Reagan may have been talking about Washington, but this message is a kingdom message. When you truly think about it, just as true today as it was 30 years ago when he concluded this message. So let your communications outward to the people and above to our Father in heaven, Avinu Shabbat Shamayim, be one that is kingdom-minded, kingdom-centered, and ultimately is kingdom-bound. So if everybody will please rise.